Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Good evening. The time is 5:59. You are listening to KBO Portland, and up next is Bread and Roses.
Okay, this is very official. Whereas, in 1964, Lloyd Livingstone wrote a letter to the editor of the Oregon Journal calling for others to engage in air pollution by forming a community radio station based on forerunners KRAB and KPFA. And whereas on June 3rd, 1968, KBOO Community Radio received a telegram from the FCC, which granted broadcast authority to operate a new station at 10 watts of power. And whereas in the past 50 years, KBOO has grown to 26,500 watts, works with over 500 volunteers, and has become an integral part of the city's cultural fabric. And whereas, throughout that history, KBOO has changed radio and the idea of what radio and media can be while honoring the unwavering love, dedication, and commitment to and from the KBOO communities. And whereas, KBOO relishes the opportunity to learn from the past and to boldly follow their hearts and ideals and mission and vision into the unknown and exciting future. Now, therefore, I, Chloe Daly, Commissioner of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, on behalf of Mayor Ted Wheeler, hereby proclaim June 3rd, 2018, to be KBOO Community Radio Day in Portland and encourage all residents to observe this day. Congratulations and thank you.
Happy birthday.
The Oregon Historical Society is featuring 50 years of KBOO. The exhibit was created to relay our history and demonstrate the importance of community radio, featuring archival photographs and ephemera collected from KBOO's 5 decades of broadcasting. The exhibit tells our story in our members' own collective words. Our online tour features highlights from the exhibit and companion audio clips to enrich visitors' experiences. The exhibit runs until July 29th at the Oregon Historical Society at 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information and audio clips can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
KBOO.
Good evening. In place of Bread and Roses this evening, we'll be playing Sojourner Truth, who will be hosting Phyllis Bennis talking about Donald Trump's administration ramping up threats against Iran and saying that if Iran threatens the U.S. ever again, Iran will suffer consequences which have never been suffered throughout history.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. The Trump administration has ramped up its threats against Iran, saying that if Iran threatens the U.S. ever again, they will suffer consequences which have never been suffered throughout history. Is this a distraction for Trump from his domestic troubles, or is he, along with Israel, really angling for a military strike against Iran? Our guest is Middle East expert Phyllis Bennis. And an update about conditions on the ground in Puerto Rico post-Hurricane Maria. And also a discussion on what the Puerto Rican people want. We speak with Francisco Santiago, co-president of the Hostosin National Independence Movement of Puerto Rico, and hundreds of thousands of protesters greeted Donald Trump on his visit to the UK. We will speak with Sarah Calloway, one of the speakers at the protest rally. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The Israeli military says it shot down a Syrian fighter jet that entered its airspace. It's only the second such incident along the Israeli-Syrian border in 30 years. The Israeli military said there has been an increase in internal fighting in Syria, including an increase in the activity of the Syrian Air Force. Six former national security officials are being targeted by President Donald Trump for their criticism of his administration. In an unprecedented move, Trump is considering revoking their security clearances. The six have served in both Republican and Democratic administrations, including Trump's. They are former CIA directors John Brennan and Michael Hayden, former FBI director Jim Comey, former director of National Intelligence James Clapper, former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, and former FBI deputy director Andrew McCabe. White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders made the announcement.
Not only is the president looking to take away Brennan's security clearance, he's also looking into the clearances of Comey, Clapper, Hayden, Rice, and McCabe. The president is exploring the mechanisms to remove security clearance because they've politicized and in some cases monetized their public service and security clearances, making baseless accusations of improper contact with Russia or being influenced by Russia against the president is extremely inappropriate. And the fact that people with security clearances are making these baseless charges provides inappropriate legitimacy to accusations with zero evidence.
McCabe and Comey currently don't have security clearances. Sanders did not cite specific comments made by any of the targeted officials, but Trump has been seething over the backlash to his meeting last week with Vladimir Putin and the ongoing investigations into Russia's meddling in the 2016 election. Democratic Representative Adam Schiff of Los Angeles, a ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, tweeted that politicizing security clearances to retaliate against former national security officials who criticized the president would set a terrible new precedent. A U.S. research group says North Korea has started dismantling key facilities at its main satellite launch site in what appears to be a step toward fulfilling a commitment made by leader Kim Jong-un at his summit with President Trump in June. An official from South Korea's presidential office said officials had also detected dismantlement activities at another North Korean launch site, but did not elaborate. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has declared 3 days of national mourning for dozens of people killed by wildfires that swept through seaside areas near Athens. The official death toll from the deadly fires that broke out yesterday stood at 50. There were fears the toll could rise as rescue crews searched through the charred remains of houses while the Coast Guard scoured the seas. Many people fled to the beaches, with some swimming out to sea to escape the choking smoke. More than 700 were evacuated from beaches. The wildfires were fed by gale-force winds and dry, hot conditions. Greek fire officials requested international help.
Due to the large expanse, the intensity, and the dangers the fires pose, the country has submitted a request through the European Civil Protection Mechanism for international ground and air assistance.
The remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera. Turkey, Germany, Spain, and Italy immediately offered assistance. The fires are the deadliest in Greece in more than a decade. In Laos, state media report that an auxiliary dam collapsed in the southeast of the country, leaving an unknown number of people dead and hundreds missing. Cascades of water swept away homes, flooded villages, and made thousands homeless. The dam was a joint project led by South Korean companies with Thai and Lao partners and was still under construction. State media described the portion that collapsed as an auxiliary dam used to hold water beyond what's held by the main dam. South Korea's Yonhap News Agency quoted one of the two South Korean partners in the project as saying rain in the area was triple the usual amount, and one of five auxiliary dams had overflowed. Many areas of Laos have recently been hit by flooding from heavy seasonal rains. California's power grid operators are calling for voluntary electricity conservation as parts of the U.S. Southwest brace for another day of scorching heat. Highs in parts of the Southwest approached 120 degrees yesterday. The National Weather Service is predicting temperatures of about 117 degrees today in Phoenix, Arizona, 108 in Texas along the border, 109 in parts of Utah. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. The country of Iran has a long history, part of the Persian Empire. In fact, it was not one of the countries that was created as a result of colonial rule. Now, since its 1979 Islamic Revolution, Tehran has been at odds with Washington. That was when the pro-Western Shah of Iran was overthrown and a Shia Islamic Revolution came to power. The Islamic Revolution rejected U.S. economics and politics, forming its own system of government. Iran is the second largest country in the Middle East with the second largest economy, making it an important player in regional and world politics. It also controls access to the Strait of Hormuz, where over 20% of the world's oil passes through. It is one of seven major maritime choke points that are critical to global energy security, this according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Like most of its neighbors, it is also a major exporter of oil, which forms the backbone of its economy. Iran, however, is the only country in the region that is predominantly Shia and led by a Shia government, placing it at odds with Saudi Arabia, which is a hardline Sunni country. There are also large numbers of Shia in Iraq. In the Middle East, Iran is allied with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Shia militias in Iraq fighting the Islamic State, as well as the Ansar Allah movement in Yemen, more commonly known as the Houthis. Saudi Arabia has accused Iran of funding the Houthis. Now, meanwhile, Saudi Arabia, with their incursion into Yemen, backed by the United States, has created an incredible human rights crisis in Yemen with their airstrikes. Globally, Iran is allied with Russia, China, and other countries that are at odds with Washington. Now, Israel, who is a nuclear power, nevertheless considers Iran a threat to its security. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been cozying up to Russia's Putin, some suspect to cause a rift between Russia and Iran. And at the recent infamous Helsinki summit, both Putin and Trump expressed some agreement related to Israeli security, although we don't really know all of what that agreement is. Now, some U.S. presidents, including Barack Obama, were open to dialogue and negotiation with Iran, but most have been apprehensive towards it. During the Obama's presidency, a nuclear deal was signed with Iran, the United States, China, France, Russia, the UK, and Germany, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. It was officially adopted in 2015 and implemented in 2016. Now, Trump, who is hawkish in Iran, he pulled the U.S. out of the deal with Iran and is doubling down on efforts to, it seems, maybe provoke a war or a military strike at the very least. Late Sunday night, July 22nd, he published a tweet that many have interpreted as a direct threat to the Middle East. Now, of course, John Bolton, who has now joined the Trump administration, is a hawk who has long called for military action against Iran. Let us go now to a clip from MSNBC about all this.
Not at all. That was today, but let's back it up to last night. It's at least still somewhat alarming when the president tweets something involving national security in all capital letters close to 11:30 at night. So this got the attention of a lot of folks, and not necessarily in a good way, when he said to and about Iran, quote, "To Iranian President Rouhani, never ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious." It was Rouhani who had spoken first. Here's his words that Trump was reacting to, quote, "America should know that peace with Iran is the mother of all peace, and war with Iran is the mother of all wars." Then our Secretary of State gave a rather blistering speech critical of Iran this weekend.
"The level of corruption and wealth among Iranian leaders shows that Iran is run by something that resembles the mafia more than a government."
Okay, something that resembles the mafia. I wonder, is he really talking about Iran or the United States? I'd like to welcome our guest, Phyllis Bennis, who directs the new Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, focusing on U.S. Middle East and war policy. She has published a number of books, including Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis, a primer. She is an expert in the region. Phyllis Bennis, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Margaret.
Okay, so Phyllis, there is a debate going on among pundits in mainstream media about whether Trump's tweet was an actual threat or a distraction, whether or not he's really angling to make a military strike on Iran. Your take on this latest spat?
I would say yes, yes, and no, the quick version.
Okay.
I think that certainly this was partly about providing a distraction to get the news attention, public attention, pundit attention away from the criticism that has rained down on him since the summit with Putin in Helsinki last week. But it's also a threat. Now, whether it was intended to be a real threat or not, it was a threat. It was a very explicit threat. And, of course, it's a complete violation of international law to use military force even against an insult or a perceived threat. It simply would violate all the prohibitions against the use of military force. Now, that doesn't mean that the threat is an actual indicator of intention to launch a military strike imminently. But, there's always a but here, it doesn't mean that it's not. And with this administration in particular, there is really no way to know. What we do know is that there was already a significant danger of escalation with Iran by the United States, escalation in the military sense. We have a Middle East policy that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and head of his Middle East team, is concocting along with Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, and their joint goal between the two of them is to develop an alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel, along with several other Gulf states, an alliance against Iran. That's designed to keep up the pressure against Iran. The competition in the region for regional hegemony between Saudi Arabia and Iran is a long-standing reality. Israel wants to move in on that, allying itself with Saudi Arabia, something that the Saudi leadership would love, the Israeli leadership would love. The problem is that the people in both those countries want no part of that, so it becomes a little bit tricky. But you combine that with the Trump advisors, who you mentioned already, John Bolton, the national security advisor, who's been a longstanding supporter of war against Iran, the Secretary of State, who's supposed to be the lead diplomat, who is clearly calling for war rather than diplomacy, although he never used the word war. Neither did he use the word diplomacy, we should note, and who talked directly in this speech that he gave in Los Angeles over the weekend about supporting the people of Iran as they overthrow their own government. Very similar to the calls that were made to the people of Iraq before the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. So it's a very dangerous scenario. We have the MEK, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, a kind of cult group in Iran that has been embraced by Republican and Democratic leaders alike, members of Congress, John Bolton. All of them have embraced this group that is has carried out terrorist actions, including against the against American citizens, was on the U.S. anti-terrorism list until 2012, when their lobbyists convinced the Obama administration to take them off the list. They have given thousands, tens of thousands of dollars over the years to high-ranking U.S. officials, members of Congress and others, paying them to speak at their conferences so they could claim these levels of support. This is a group that is widely hated inside Iran, primarily because it fought against Iran with Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq during the 10 years of the Iran-Iraq War. So this group has now reemerged as a major factor in Washington. That makes everything more dangerous. And then lastly, we have to, well, two other things. One, briefly on the question of Korea, where there does seem to be some initiatives underway, that there could be moves towards peace in Korea. In a certain perverse way, that makes the danger of a U.S. war against Iran even more dangerous, because there are so many forces in this administration, Bolton and Pompeo at the top of the list, as well as Trump himself, who clearly want a war somewhere. And if there's not going to be a war in Korea, then a war with Iran looks even more likely. And finally, we have the question of what might spark something like this. I don't think there's any indication that the Trump administration right now is preparing a unilateral direct strike against Iran at the moment. But the Strait of Hormuz is a very crowded waterway. There's a lot of ships there. The skies over Syria are very crowded skies. There's a lot of fighter jets. There's a lot of planes flying around. All of these scenarios lend themselves to the possibility of a small accident, a real accident, not intended by anybody to be anything, but a small accident between a U.S. and Iranian boats, for instance, ships, planes, anything that could happen without the possibility of a quick calming down, because there's very little communication, not even the kind of military-to-military communication there is between the U.S. and Russia in Syria. You don't have that in the Strait of Hormuz, for instance. So the danger of an accidental war rises exponentially.
Yeah, and just, you know, it seems, I mean, a couple of things here. We know that Israel, as well as the United States, they're clearly very interested in isolating, further isolating Iran. for a number of reasons. But also, Trump has been crowing about the protests that have been going on the ground across Iran. And the people of Iran likely have some very legitimate reasons why they're out there protesting, which may have nothing to do with U.S.-Iran tensions. Now, in terms of Rouhani, became president of Iran in 2013, right? And while Obama was the president, and prior to that was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was very hostile to Western forces. So, Rouhani, he's considered a bit of a moderate, is he not?
Well, he's considered a moderate, certainly rhetorically.
Okay.
But I think it's important to recognize that there's a lot of unity in Iran in opposing what the U.S. is trying to do with Israel and others to isolate Iran, and the sanctions. The sanctions were imposed under the regime of Ahmadinejad, but have continued with Rouhani. And the problem that Rouhani faces right now, and the likely reason that he wrote his message the other day, saying that peace with the United States would be the mother of all peace, but warning that war with between the United States and Iran could be the mother of all wars. I think what he was responding to was popular pressure. He was elected on the grounds that by supporting the Iran nuclear deal, which other Iranian leaders had opposed, he was the big supporter of it. And his support was based on the idea that with the lifting of sanctions, Iran's economy would improve and life would improve significantly for ordinary people. That began to happen very slowly, but that slight beginning has now been reversed because of the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal and its resumption of sanctions. So with the resumption of sanctions, things are getting bad again, and Rouhani is under political pressure as a result. A lot of the protests are focusing on those economic developments that are impoverishing many people in Iran. So Rouhani is threatened electorally. He has to go up for elections, and he can't make the claim now that he was making earlier that his support for the Iran nuclear deal will definitely lead to a better life for Iranians, because the U.S. has undermined it. So he has given credibility, in a sense. The U.S. decision, the Trump decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, has given more credibility and brought more support to the hardliners. But in the context of the protests that are underway, any attempt to claim that these are protests calling for the overthrow of the regime is not just wishful thinking on the part of Pompeo or Bolton or Trump or the Foundation for the Defense of the Democracies or anything else. This is a very dangerous using as an excuse the claim that because people are protesting, in fact what they're protesting is the impact of U.S. sanctions. They're protesting how that's affecting their lives. They want their government to do something about it. These are not protests that are calling for the end of the regime.
Yeah, and clearly the starve them out has been a strategy used by the United States against governments that they don't have much truck with. And one has to wonder, I mean, you mentioned earlier North Korea, that seems to be making some moves in the direction that Trump wants. One has to wonder what is really behind that, because if you look at the history, I mean, I'm totally against nuclear weapons, but when you look at what happened in Libya with Gaddafi, for example, who right. gave up the nuclear weapons, Libya is now a failed state, right? Now, and some people are saying, but wait a minute, Trump may be emboldened by his quote-unquote strategy dealing with North Korea, but that Iran is no North Korea. So
the
strategy isn't going to work.
Any effort to sort of equate the two countries is a very dangerous one. In North Korea, it was possible for Kim Jong-un to reverse his policy essentially overnight based on his own assessment of the situation. This is a regime that's very much it's not a one-man show altogether, but there is enormous power vested in one individual. That's not the case in Iran. The leader in Iran, Khamenei, can probably prevent any specific act taken by an Iranian president. Even that isn't necessarily so clear, but that's likely. But decisions, affirmative decisions to move in a certain way, for example, to reverse its long-standing 40-year position of opposition to U.S. domination in the region, would have to be a very complex, would have to involve a very complex set of actors, political actors, military, economic actors across the country. The system in Iran is a far more complex one. It involves far more people, far more competing social forces than is the case in North Korea. So it's not, you don't have somebody who's, whether it's the president, the prime minister, anybody else, is not going to stand up and say, you know what, I think we should reverse ourselves and begin new discussions with the United States. Now, there has been a call from the Iranian leadership for negotiations with the United States for decades, and they have been very clear about what they want those talks to be about, not only about nuclear weapons, but about Iran's role in the region. They want recognition that Iran is what it is. It's a major regional power. A set of things to be on the agenda. Normalization of relations between the U.S. and Iran, the so-called grand bargain that was offered years ago. So it's not to say that there could not be negotiations between the U.S. And Iran, but it's not going to be negotiations solely on the question of the nuclear issue. There was willingness on Iran's part to engage in those negotiations around the Iran nuclear deal because it was global negotiations. It involved all the major powers in the world. It involved Russia, China, Europe, both collectively and individually, Germany, France, the UK. All the major powers were engaged, and what it was going to lead to was at the economic normalization of Iran in the world, if it had been allowed to go forward. But the question of bilateral negotiations between Iran and the United States are going to have to take up broader issues around that, and the notion that the United States is prepared for that, simply there's no indication of that so far.
Right, and finally, how is Rouhani and Iran going to move in all this? Because there was some talk about perhaps a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, but that doesn't seem, I haven't heard anything about that recently. But also, they are in the shtuk because although the countries from the EU did not pull out of the nuclear deal with Iran, still those businesses that are trading with oil or whatever with Iran, they're going to be penalized by the United States.
They already are.
They already are.
That's already underway.
Yeah.
The U.S. is engaging with a major pressure campaign against European and Asian businesses, banks, telling them essentially, look, you can do what you want, but if you do, if you trade with Iran, if you buy Iranian oil, you will pay a price. We won't trade with you. It's similar to what the U.S. did for so many decades against Cuba. But, of course, the Iranian economy is far bigger. The world is far more reliant on Iranian oil than it was on Cuban tourism or sugar. But it was the same principle, that when only the U.S. was imposing sanctions on Cuba, the rest of the U.N. was completely opposed to those sanctions. But the practice of the U.S. was to pass laws that said things like any cruise ship that docks at a Cuban port is not allowed to come to the United States for 6 months. And then ship owners would have to decide, where's the money going to come from, the very small market of Havana or the enormous markets of the United States? So the U.S. economic power continues this kind of attack. I think that what we're looking at right now is very serious in terms of the dangers of any of these reckless moves by Trump administration officials escalating far beyond their intention, far beyond what they may think they intend. There is the danger of any kind of accident leading to a military escalation. The new consolidation of this Israeli-Saudi-UAE alliance against Iran bodes very badly for the intent, for the possibilities of avoiding war in the region. So this is a very dangerous moment.
Right. Well, on that note, we're going to continue to follow this. And Phyllis Bennis, we appreciate you breaking this down for us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take our station break. And coming up, the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, what are movements on the ground demanding, and Trump's trip to the UK. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
To me. Oh, oh, I despise, 'cause it means destruction of innocent lives. War means tears, 10,000 of mothers die when their sons go out to fight and lose their
Alrighty, and that song is War, What Is It Good For? By Edwin Starr. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. We are also online. You can check out our show on our website at sotrueradio.org, where we have a community calendar and other information. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And today we'd like to do a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners and in Puerto Rico. We are on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And we would also like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners. In fact, we want to give a shout out to all of the teachers across not only Southern California, but across the nation who are listeners of Sojourner Truth. We're now going to turn our attention to Puerto Rico, where millions are still reeling in the wake of Hurricanes Irma and Maria. The hurricanes struck the island and other parts of the Caribbean in late August and early September of 2017. Streets and homes were flooded entire, neighborhoods flooded, left without electrical power. Clean water became practically impossible to find. An estimated 4,645 people died in Hurricane Maria and its aftermath in Puerto Rico, according to a May 2018 New England Journal of Medicine study. Up to 8,000 people were injured or affected by its impact. It took just 10 days for FEMA to approve aid for Texas after Hurricane Harvey devastated the area. But it took them 43 days for Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. Trump didn't visit Puerto Rico for 13 days after it struck. And at one point, he even said that Puerto Ricans want everything done for them. Many may remember his the insulting view of Trump throwing paper towels at people on the ground in Puerto Rico. A study has said that FEMA, of course, was totally unprepared for it. And now that people in Florida who had to flee to Florida are now losing, could end up homeless because FEMA has closed its program, its housing program, if you would believe this. So a lot going on. And what we're going to do now is to go to a short clip from Bloomberg.
Months after Hurricane Maria, Puerto Rico is still in peril. Huge swaths of the island are still without power, running water, or access to medical care. Experts estimate that it will take years before these services are restored island-wide. Much of the blame has been placed on FEMA for a slow response in comparison to recent disasters on the mainland. But recovery from a disaster of this complexity and scale has proven more challenging than anyone anticipated. And filling the gaps between an overextended public sector and a suffering populace falls on the private citizens.
I see two Puerto Ricos. We're here in San Juan. They have telecommunications restored. It may or may not have power, but basic services are in place. They're able to get food. They're able to buy things. They're surviving. And when you look outside of the San Juan area, you can go 15 minutes from here and find areas that are devastated.
All righty. There you go. I'd like to welcome our guest, Francisco Santiago, co-president of the Hostosiano National Independence Movement of Puerto Rico. It is a progressive and pro-independence organization that's organizing with students, workers, and farmers for independence in Puerto Rico in the wake of Hurricane Maria, and also organizes protests against U.S. colonization of Puerto Rico. Francisco, welcome.
Hi, thank you for letting me in this space, and big hi to everyone that's listening.
All righty. Now, from your perspective, how are things looking on the ground in terms of recovery from the hurricanes?
Well, the things are recovering. I think that if you want to actually see the real devastation that has happened, you have to analyze things how they were in even before Hurricane Maria. Puerto Rico is a U.S. colony since 1898. It has been in an economic depression since 2006, more so when they have a fiscal board imposed by Congress since last year. For you to get a big perspective, we're talking about at least 500,000 Puerto Ricans before Hurricane Maria left the island because of the economic crisis. This economic crisis also made the government completely unable to actually attend crises. And so when Hurricane Maria came, it was just the last drop that completely destroyed everything else, no? And so what we have here is an economic downturn where people, before Hurricane Maria, were struggling in their daily lives to survive. After Hurricane Maria, we're talking about a mass exodus to the United States and to anywhere else in the world where they could actually make a living. Besides, obviously, the person that couldn't make it and died because of government negligence in the process. I mean, if we're going to talk about how things are right now in the day by day, I think like two days ago, one of the biggest scandals that just happened is that there are still corpses in the Forensic Institute of Puerto Rico that are there since last year because there has been a profound negligence in the handling of the situation. We have been constantly demanding to see what forensics think is the real number of deaths because of Maria since the New England study you mentioned, and we still haven't had any type of official response from the government.
Right. Now, one of the things during and the aftermath of the hurricane that we were covering was the impact of the Jones Act, officially known as the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. Now, that's still in effect today. Tell us about that and the impact that that has had.
Well, the Jones Act has always had an impact on the Puerto Rican economy. We're talking about how Puerto Rico is, in terms of U.S. territories, the poorest U.S. territory, but at the same time, it has one of the highest cost of living. The median salary range in Puerto Rico right now, as of today, is between $21,000 to $22,000, just the median range in the island. We're talking that more than 60% of children in the island live below the poverty level as defined by the U.S. Federal Bureau. And at least 70% or more of people have some type of federal aid because of that reality. So what we're talking about here is that curiously, after Irma, they suspended the Jones Act for a while, but after Maria, they didn't. And so what we have is a combination of factors that completely frustrate any real effort to attend the situation that was going on in Puerto Rico. We had countries that were constantly offering aid for Puerto Rico, and since the ports were maneuvered by FEMA, they were negated. And actually, talking about FEMA, also one thing that I wanted to say was that another scandal that got back yesterday, besides the one about Puerto Ricans that are facing homelessness in Florida, is that more than 70% of the petitions for FEMA in the island have been negated by FEMA for the reconstruction of the homes that were affected. And we are right now in hurricane season again.
Yeah.
Last week we had a tropical storm coming by, and we have had families that are still living with the blue plastic covers in their houses almost a year after the hurricane, and that they haven't had zero help from FEMA. The only people that are helping are the community, and the only people that are helping are themselves and the diaspora, and obviously people from around the world that have seen the injustices that are happening here. But what I want to say is that FEMA has been completely negligent in the handling of the situation.
Right, and the press, they're reporting that 900 people displaced from Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands are still depending on FEMA's housing assistance in Florida, but FEMA is ending that assistance. And that brings us to the question. There's been a great debate that's been going on, I think, for decades in relation to Puerto Rico about either statehood or independence. And then there's something called free association, which I'm not quite sure what that means. But in 2012, there was a vote, and people voted for statehood, we're told, by 50%. Secondly was free association, but independent status came in third. And I wonder if you could give us a sense about how widespread is support for independence. I know that's a movement that you are part of. And do people trust that vote that happened not only in 2012, but also in 2017, and now another vote on statehood for Puerto Rico is being put forward in the U.S. Congress? Your comments.
Well, first of all, there are different questions, so I'll go one by one. In terms of respect and the approach for the Puerto Rico independence movement, I'll be explicitly clear, we have a lot of work to do, and we're striving to do that work. But in terms of what we're talking about, of the legitimacy of those plebiscites that were pushed by the New Progressive Party, that's the right-wing party that right now is governing Puerto Rico, nobody actually thinks that besides them it's a legitimate vote, and I'll explain why. In terms of the 2012 plebiscite, the 2012 plebiscite had a structure of two question structure. The first one was if you wanted Puerto Rico to continue to be a colony, yes or no. And besides that, the second question was if you decide that Puerto Rico doesn't, if you think Puerto Rico can't be a colony, which of these do you prefer? And then you went to the other options. The problem with that plebiscite is that, first of all, the only legitimate expression that actually you can say that happened over there was that Puerto Rico doesn't want to be a colony. That was the vote that got more than 50% of the vote. In terms of the other one, the problem was that you had a filter with the first question, and then you came with the second question, and then you, let's say, inflated the numbers in the second question. But when you totaled the whole aspect of the situation, you didn't have a majority voting for statehood. More so when other parts of society campaigned for a boycott of the plebiscite that signified more than 100,000 votes that didn't went to the act of the plebiscite. In the second plebiscite, that's the one we're also talking about, and that's the one that the New Progressive Party is using to push their bout for statehood, all sectors of society except the New Progressive Party participated in that plebiscite, and that's why you had a supermajority in that plebiscite. But nobody believes that is a legitimate expression of the Puerto Rican population. Not even Congress believes that.
Yeah, okay.
Last week, the representative that doesn't have a vote but only a voice in the lower chamber, when I went again for a petition of statehood, we were talking, me and my friends, and we said, well, which one of all of them? Because I think it's the fourth time that she brings a petition of statehood in these last 3 years, and it all has gone to deaf ears. I think that the important thing here, and the thing that we have to everyone, not only the Puerto Rican population, but the U.S. population has to demand, is that we're already in the 21st century, and it is completely preposterous for a country to have colonies.
Yeah.
And that you have to assure and promote the self-determination of the country. Indifferently of
right. Francisco, for people yeah. who want to be in touch and support the work that you're doing, we're out of time, so I'll need for you to tell us how they can get in touch with you, what they can do.
Well, you can go to our Facebook pages. You can write to us. It's in Spanish, but you can write to us in English. As you can see, we can defend ourselves.
Okay. Well, if you send it to us, we'll post it on our social media so it would make it a little easier for our listeners to follow that.
Sure. We are right now constantly going to communities to help after the hurricane.
Okay.
We're constantly going to places affected. Any help is more than we're more than grateful for any help and right. thank you all for the space.
Okay, thank you, Francisco Santiago. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, Donald Trump made that infamous trip to Europe recently, first with NATO, where he caused quite a ruckus with his hostility towards governments who have been traditional allies to the United States. Then he went to the UK, where he gave an explosive interview of putting down the conservative, by the way, Theresa May of the Tory party there, while promoting her opponent, Boris Johnson. And then he went off to Scotland to play golf, right? He also insulted immigrants by saying that immigrants were bad for the culture of Europe. And but, you know, that trip to the UK had been postponed for a long time because people in the UK were not having it and had threatened to pull out hundreds of thousands of people in protest, and that indeed did happen. We're going to go now to hear some of the sound from the protests of hundreds of thousands of people in London, England. We'll hear from Angela, who is with All Africa Women's Group, and Sarah Calloway, who campaigns with that group and is also with Women of Color in the Global Women's Strike. Let's go to that clip now.
His friends in Africa, Middle East, and everywhere else. We came together 15 years ago, and every day we fight detention, deportation, and destitution. We are your neighbors and your friends. Yes. With voluntary return process. The hostile environment is not just against weak people, but all of us. And it is Trump, what Trump wants all over the world. Trump is here telling the government to spend more money on military. His own country are starving. We all have the right to eat.
Trump and his fascist friends. He backed Israel in the slaughter of Palestinian people. But our response is boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. And that is how we oppose apartheid and racism everywhere. And against their puppet president imposed by the U.S. They want them out. Trump is attacking women, including by threatening Ecuador with trade sanctions for promoting breastfeeding. This is an attack on the lives of women and all our children. But there is a growing movement even in Trump's America. It's called the Poor People's Campaign. It is multiracial, anti-sexist, against poverty, racism, the war economy, and ecological devastation. Thousands have been arrested in civil disobedience, and they're growing every day. We must make that movement worldwide. And we on this demo are part of that worldwide movement. Dump Trump.
Okay, Dump Trump, I'd like to welcome just for a few minutes here. We have left here Sarah Calloway. She's based in the UK, and you just heard Sarah speak. She was the final speaker that ended with Dump Trump. Sarah, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sarah, first of all, give us a sense about what are the numbers, because we didn't get a lot of reports on the protests, the anti-Trump protests. Give us a sense of the size of it.
Well, it was massive. There were 250,000 people in London alone, and it was the biggest ever weekday demonstration in the UK, in all of UK history. And it was the biggest turnout since the anti-Iraq war demonstrations back in around 2003. And people were organizing across every movement and every sector. People had been organizing for weeks. And it was it turned into a carnival. Not only in London, but in other cities, in Sheffield, in Cambridge, up in Scotland, the two main cities, Glasgow and Edinburgh, had massive demonstrations, and people even managed to get onto Trump's golf course with protest placards.
Really?
To make clear, yes, that he was not welcome. And it was funny to see that the police were smiling and obviously thought it was quite, you know, a good thing for people to be protesting. So people are still buzzing from the turnout and from the, you know, the feeling here. People felt that Trump had come, he wanted Europe to spend more on war, and he'd come here as part of the right wing, not only of the Tory party, which Theresa May is part of, but also part of the people who want to leave the EU and are using immigrants, have really done a massive attack on immigrant people to make the case for the UK leaving Europe. And we are in fear because we know that what Trump wants is to separate Britain from the rest of the EU, and so that we're under Trump's wing, and people are absolutely enraged and resisting that on every level.
Yeah, and just quickly, Angela spoke before you from the All Africa Women's Group. You're also a campaigner working with the All African Women's Group. How important